Why the flare-up between Armenia and Azerbaijan? A Russian-brokered ceasefire seems to be holding so far after the worst fighting since last year's 44-day war over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. This time, it's also a border dispute, one that was being negotiated. We'll ask about the stakes surrounding what is a crossroads for neighbors like Iran and Turkey, and also the role played by Russia, broker of last year's truce and allied both with Armenia, where it has a military base, and with oil-rich Azerbaijan, whose leader Ilhan Aliyev has proved deft in courting both Moscow and Turkey. Can the Kremlin play peacemaker in the Caucasus while it takes on NATO and the EU on its Western front? 30 years on, what does it all say about the former Soviet Union? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at the flare-up between Armenia and Azerbaijan. With us, French Member of Parliament Jacques-Marie Lossian chairs the France-Armenia Parliamentary Friendship Group. You're just back. Thank you for being with us.
Good evening.
From Baku, Javid Aga, journalist at BNE Intellinews, which covers emerging markets. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening.
From Berlin, he's Georgia's former European Integration Minister, Tornike Gordadze, a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Good to see you.
Good evening. Thank you.
And from Moscow, Andrei Kortanov, Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council think tank. Thanks for joining us again. The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation, and you have on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. Yeah, last year's war was all about that enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, an Armenian-speaking territory surrounded by Azerbaijan. Monday's clashes about Baku's exclave, you could call it, of Nakhichevan. Monty Francis has more.
More than a year after a ceasefire ended a war over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh, tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan are once again on the rise. The ceasefire agreement itself is at the center of the latest conflict. Article 9 provides for the construction of new transport routes linking the Autonomous Republic of Nakhichevan and the western regions of Azerbaijan. A path that travels over the Zangezur Mountains and through the Sunik region in southern Armenia. The project is moving ahead, according to the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev, who said in a statement, "The Zangezur Corridor is a project capable of connecting the Turkish world, Europe, and our neighbors. And today, active work is underway to realize this project." To that end, the Azerbaijani army has taken control of nearly 40 square kilometers within Armenian territory.
For Azerbaijan, it's a matter of having a direct route to Nakhichevan, which happens to be at the Turkish border, which is Baku's political and military ally. For Armenia, it is an extremely difficult decision to make, since it is a question of accepting that its two enemies can cross its territory.
On Tuesday, Russia's defense minister brokered a ceasefire that brought the fighting to a stop, at least for now. This week's clashes are the worst since a six-week war last year over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 people.
Okay, so it can be a little confusing for people who don't follow this on a day-to-day basis. Jacques-Marie Lossian, what we know is that you have people who are Armenian, who are Azeris. They're not all in one homogeneous group. And if we look at this map, we get a sense of why the fighting is taking place. Explain to us what happened on Monday by looking at it.
Oh, you have to go back to one century ago. The region of Nagorno-Karabakh was inhabited by, let's say, at the time, 95% Armenian people at that time, in the beginning of the 20th century. And then when the Soviet Union was created, Joseph Stalin in 21 gave the Nagorno-Karabakh region to the Federation of Azerbaijan, despite the fact that it was inhabited by 95% of Armenian people. And in these regions, you have churches, monasteries that have maybe 1,000 years, right? And after that, during the Soviet Union, the population changed a little bit. And then the proportion of Armenian in Karabakh went down to 80%, right? But at the time the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, these republics that belonged to Soviet Union declared their independence, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and of course, Armenia. And inside Azerbaijan, the district of Karabakh declared its independence.
So you've got an Armenian enclave inside of Azerbaijan.
Yes.
And a
Azeri enclave between Turkey, Iran, and Armenia.
So Monday's clashes, what happened?
As far as I know, and as far this is confirmed by international authorities, some people are claiming that it has been a border clash. I was in Armenia the last 3 days. What I heard, it's not a border clash after a provocation by Armenian military troops. As far as I know, the Azerbaijan army tried to enter the state of the region of Syunik, because for them it is the shortest way to Nakhichevan. And as far as I know, Mr. Aliyev is of course intending to create a corridor between Nakhichevan and Azerbaijan. As of today, we are, based on my experience, manipulated by the Azerbaijani government, which is always claiming that Azeri army is just responding to Armenian provocation.
Right.
Which is, to my view, a nonsense.
All right. Javed Aga, I don't want to go into who started the shooting on Monday, because neither you nor I were there present. But let me ask you, what's your reading of what happened? You heard in that report a moment ago, our correspondent say that this had followed negotiations over transit through these enclaves.
Yes, till Monday there have been statements by the foreign ministers of Azerbaijan and Armenia that they are getting positive signals from both sides on the negotiations. It mean the way I read it, it seems that they were close to some deal, but there was one thing that they did not agree upon. And I think that it's not about the corridor. The opening of transportations were already in the statement of November back in 2020 when the war ended. There have been clear statements that both Azerbaijan and Armenia should let each other to go to whatever they want via the territories of the countries. But what Azerbaijan wants right now is to make Armenia to accept border demarcation, which would mean that acceptance of Karabakh inside Azerbaijani territories. And I think that this was the real problem, that Armenia did not want it to happen. They are going to say, let's discuss status of Karabakh matter later. But Azerbaijani stance is that there's not going to be any status for Karabakh. So in my opinion, it's more about making Armenia to accept Azerbaijani borders that in no way demarcated, because since Soviet Union breakup, there were no any diplomatic relations between these countries.
But there have been negotiations, and we saw back in February Armenia's prime minister welcoming the news that Azerbaijan was going to restore a key rail line that would link Russia to the go through the region. Why can't they finalize that deal?
Yes, as you have also mentioned, this is not about transport. This is about some strategic heights that where Armenia or Azerbaijan can monitor each other's territories. Now, when you capture a strategic height, it means that you are virtually controlling the other side's territory. You are looking upon their villages. And these are one of the main points in this conflict.
Andrei Kortunov, for you, what's this about? Why were they fighting on Monday?
Well, I think that there are many issues on which they cannot agree. But the most important issue, of course, is the future status of Nagorno-Karabakh. If you take the Azeri position, they reject that such a problem exists. For them, the problem is resolved. Karabakh is back to Azerbaijan, and they do not intend to sign any new international agreements on the status of this territory. When you go to Yerevan, of course, the position is very different. They do believe that the issue is not resolved, that the question of self-determination should be raised once again. And they hope that sooner or later, this territory will become independent from Azerbaijan, and later on it might be reunited with Armenia. So the issue of status is, of course, the most difficult issue, and this is an issue that cannot be resolved at this stage. On top of that, we have the issue of demarcation, and indeed, both sides appeal to old Soviet maps, and they have different reading of these maps. So these border clashes are unfortunately almost unavoidable. Plus, there are more specific issues related to the recent conflict. Armenians claim that Azerbaijan detains some of the prisoners of war, while the other side argues that Armenians are not ready to share the maps of the map. In Nagorno-Karabakh, and that's why, you know, they
All right, the line's breaking up slightly there, Andre. We're going to try to reconnect with you. Apologies for that. We're having a bit of crackle on the phone line. Tornike Gordadze, is this going to go on forever, or is there common ground between Armenians and Azerbaijan?
This conflict has started with the end of the Soviet Union. It started before the end of the Soviet Union. As soon as Perestroika was launched by Mikhail Gorbachev, the first claims of the the Armenians who inhabit this region of Nagorno-Karabakh was to reunite back with Armenia. So this is a very old conflict. We can go much earlier in the history, the beginning of the 20th century, there were already clashes between Azeris and Armenians in different parts.
It's an old conflict, therefore it's impossible to resolve? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think nothing is impossible. We saw in Europe, in the European continent, the conflicts, the like centuries-old conflicts between Germany and France, between Britain and France, and Britain and Germany, and major European countries solved, and now they live peacefully. Of course, nothing is impossible, but these actors should have interest in resolving the conflict. And also, don't forget that these countries are relatively small countries, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, a few others, and major international actors and regional powers like Russia, Turkey, Iran, to a lesser extent, these last several years, United States and European Union, they also have their interests. And so far, after the ceasefire in 1994, Russia's ambition was to keep the conflict frozen, but not to go until the final solution of the conflict, because Russia could keep leverages on both sides. Now, Azerbaijan has changed a little bit the balance of power in its favor, and now Azerbaijan is trying to gain more diplomatically from its military superiority from Armenia. So the international actors, mediators like Russia, Turkey, etc., they also have to help these countries to find a definite, a final solution between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and in order to try to satisfy both countries, find a compromise, which is not easy, I agree, but nothing is impossible.
Nothing is impossible. And again, I'll put it to you, Jacques-Marie Lossian, is the common ground this idea that if you are able to shore up transit hubs, be they road or rail, it's win-win for both Armenia and Azerbaijan?
I would agree if the situation would be could have been a fair situation. On one side, you have a democracy, Armenia. On the other side, you have a dictatorship. So you have a people who have been elected by their people, and twice the Armenian people had elections in 2018 and recently in 2020, where Nikol Pashinyan won the elections for the second time. On the other side, you have Mr. Aliyev. And we know Mr. Aliyev is acting like a dictator. So you cannot negotiate. When you mention France and...
So what, you're saying that until Azerbaijan becomes a democracy, there can't be a solution?
I believe that it can be a solution as long as Mr. Aliyev has totally a different agenda. It's an hidden agenda. What the international community must understand, you cannot negotiate with Mr. Aliyev. He's always lying and manipulating things. When he says, just an example, the claim from the Azerbaijani government is, we have been just reacting against Armenian provocation at the border. Why the hell would Armenian people attack or provoke Azerbaijanis? I was in Armenia for the last 4 days. The Armenian people want to live peacefully. There are absolutely no interest to make any provocation against
Azerbaijan. But you heard Andrei Kortanov mention that it's volatile. Part of the reason it's volatile is that these borders are ill-drawn, the maps date back to Soviet times, and that it's very easy for a spark to light the fire.
As you mentioned, and the right term, it has been a frozen conflict since 93, last century. And at the time the war started, these two states were Soviet states. So at that time, nobody cared about what the frontier looks like. So it means when the Armenian part in Karabakh won some Azeri district, nobody cared about the delimitation of what they called Karabakh and Azerbaijan. Now Azerbaijan has won the old district. And now the question is, where is exactly the frontier between Armenia and Azerbaijan? And there is a process with the group of Minsk, with the three co-presidents, Russia, United States, and France, to find a way to validate the borders between Armenia and Azerbaijan.
Azerbaijan. We heard Thornike Gordadze mention how the momentum after last year's war is clearly right now with Azerbaijan. And on November 9th, we saw commemorations on both sides of the border. In Yerevan, it was a solemn occasion. Remember, it was 44 days of fighting that left some 6,500 dead, and Armenia suffering a major defeat on the battlefield. There you see the prime minister laying a wreath. In Baku, November 9th was, well, more flag-waving and muscle-flexing, the country's president of 18 years, putting aside modesty as he looked to the future.
As you witnessed, thousands and tens of thousands of Azeri youngsters, soldiers and officers clashed with the enemy and showed them their place. The enemy has been thrown into such a position that they will never be able to get out of it again. They will live forever as a defeated nation and a defeated state.
They will live forever as a defeated nation and a defeated state. Javid Agaz, that does not sound like someone who wants to make peace.
The peace has different meanings for both Armenians and Azerbaijanis. Before the war, even during the war, you could say that we want peace, we want peace. But this had different meanings for both of us. For Azerbaijanis, it meant that we retake Karabakh and then we sign a peace deal with Armenia that each other recognize our borders. For Armenia, you already know that the panelists have already mentioned that this was not the case. So as for Aliyev's speech, it is not the first, and it has been going on for a year now since the end of the war, that because there was a huge disbelief in the government that Aliyevs are only stalling the situation, they are not actually wanting to get Karabakh back. It was one of the major criticisms by opposition, who actually lost the first war to Armenia. So
he's rubbing it in both for what you're saying is the message is both for the international community, but also for his domestic audience.
Exactly. I agree.
Yes, both. That, and he also mentioned that during these 30 years of period, Nicole Pashinyan and his democracy has only been in government for like 2 or 3 years now. And he always mentioned Sarkisian and Kocharyan, previous governments, that the guys who actually accused of being authoritarian and who actually invaded Karabakh in Azerbaijani eyes. So Pashinyan is only seen as a new mere leader who does not really know how politics is going in Azerbaijani eyes.
All right, so there's the point we haven't mentioned yet, which is the man who brokered Monday's truce, and that is Vladimir Putin. Andrei Kortnev, right now, what's the calculus in Moscow? Oh, we've lost Moscow. We'll try to reconnect there with Andrei Kortnev. Once again, we're having trouble there with the connection. Let me put it to you, Tornike Gortadze. What's the calculus in Moscow? Russia has a military base in Armenia, mm-hmm. but it has warm ties with both sides. Right now, you were saying how in the past it was rooting for a frozen conflict. Is it still the case?
I think Russia's interest, as always, is to keep influence in the region and keep influence on both sides. That's why Russia stopped the war in the last year, mm-hmm. a year ago, in November 2020, when the Azeris were on the, they were almost taking the control of the whole region of the Karabakh. Then Russia stopped the war to keep also Armenians a little bit not totally defeated and to keep good relations with Armenians, because Armenians were extremely disappointed by Russia's behavior during the last year's conflict, because Russia not only has a military base in Armenia, but Armenia is a member of Russia-brokered defense union, where Russia has the obligation to defend Armenia's territory. This is not the case of Karabakh, which is internationally, according to international law, is not part of Armenia, but Russia has the obligation to defend Armenia's territory. In exchange of this, Armenia abandoned a portion of its sovereignty to Russia since the last several years. So the Armenians were very disappointed, and Russia tried to save its role as a broker and also to save the role of one of the only true military ally of Armenia. Since several years, the European Union and the United States are helping Armenia to make democratic reforms. They are supporting the current government of Armenia, and I agree with the previous speakers that current Armenian government is much more democratic than the previous ones and much more looking towards the West. But the West has no strategic influence, military influence in the region. Only Russia and now Turkey, together with Azerbaijan, have influence in the region. So Russia will do anything to keep both countries dependent on Russia. It's not in Russia's interest to have Azerbaijan winning definitely and 100% and obtaining everything. Otherwise, Russia will lose influence on Azerbaijan, which is already much less dependent on Russia than Armenia, because Azerbaijan has its own resources, has very good relations with Turkey, and appears as militarily also linked to Turkey. So Russia needs also to conserve this situation inside the Karabakh, to conserve its troops in Karabakh. Russia sent 2,000 peacekeepers in Karabakh. In Karabakh, and when it comes to Armenia also, now it's in Russia's interest not to allow Azerbaijan to go further and to have 100% victory over Armenia.
Andrei Kortnev, do you agree that the view from Moscow on Baku has changed over the past year, or has changed certainly with the last year's war, when they saw how Azerbaijan won so decisively?
Well, I think that definitely there is a change in perception of Azerbaijan. Many in Moscow didn't believe that Azerbaijan was in a position to win over Armenia. I think that definitely they have to reassess the military capacity of Azerbaijan. I think that what they should be concerned about is not exactly Azerbaijan, but rather the growing role of Turkey in the region. Because if Turkey has its foot in the doorway in the South Caucasus, it can reach out to other parts of the former Soviet Union, including Central Asia and maybe even North Caucasus and some Muslim regions of the Russian Federation proper. And of course, given the pan-Islamic trends and neo-Ottoman trends in the Turkish foreign policy, that should be a matter of concern for politicians in Moscow.
Yeah, and you mentioned wariness of Turkey. The game changer in last year's war was undoubtedly drones. Drones made, guess where? In Turkey, also in Israel, but mostly in Turkey, used by Azerbaijan to the surprise of the international community. 1 year on, Turkish-made drones again making news, this time at the other end of the former Soviet Empire, with Ukraine last month using them against Russian-backed separatists in the Donbass, in the east of Ukraine. And that has got President Putin lashing out, both at Turkey, but also at the European Union.
Europe had an unintelligible response to this, and the U.S. even supported it. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say outright that they deployed it and will continue to do so in the future. At the same time, they've organized unscheduled military exercises in the Black Sea. It's as if they don't want us to let down our guard. We'll let them know that we aren't letting our guard down.
Jacques-Marie Lossian, are drones kind of changing the balance of power everywhere right now?
Yes, we are. I am also a member of the French Defense Committee in the Assemblée Nationale. And this conflict was a high-intensity conflict. The problem came from the fact that on the Armenian side, some people believed that they were still able to counter any Azeri attack, because the region is full of mountains. So the position, the defending position, is always stronger when you are attacked first. And also they were believing that what they did 30 years ago was something repeatable. They were, may I say, blind. Because what happened 30 years ago, you had two countries that were Soviet countries, and they were fighting with the same weapons. The Kalashnikov, the T-55 on both sides. This time, it seems that the on the Armenian side, no investment was made to rearm. And then, during that time, Azerbaijan made a tremendous effort to modernize the weapons and to modernize the strategy. And, of course, with drones, with special weapons, the Azeri army was really able to defeat the Armenian army.
And we've seen there was a troop built up by Russia near Ukraine's border last week that has NATO scrambling. Again, it's after this drone attack by the Ukrainian military, Turkish-made drones. Why is it spooking Russia to that point? Can't they have drones of their own? Can't they have an answer to those drones?
The challenge for Russia is that, as far as I know, the Russian economy is not as strong as it was during the Soviet Union. And the amount of, let's say, dollars that the Russian state can dedicate to its defense is lower than it was in the past. So the Russian army cannot be everywhere. They have nuclear weapons. They have nuclear submarines. Nowadays, they have lost their aircraft carrier because it has been damaged. So the challenge for Mr. Putin is, of course, to be strong, but they can't spend a huge amount of money to do it. So they have to make a choice.
Andrei Kortnov, again, we're talking about drones and drones made in Turkey.
Well, you know, let me put it in a slightly different perspective. I think that the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh demonstrated that you can resolve territorial issues using military force. And that sets a very dangerous precedent for all other frozen conflicts on the territory of the former Soviet Union, because politicians in Kyiv or in Chisinau or elsewhere might decide, well, it worked for Aliyev, it should work for us as well. And I think this is the concern that they have in Moscow. And this is why Moscow is trying to deter potential military action by Kyiv by deploying more troops on the border with Ukraine. They're concerned that this example, successful example of President Aliyev, might be replicated in other parts where Russia's interests are more significant than in case of Nagorno-Karabakh.
So, Tornike Gordadze, does that mean just everyone, if everyone just goes out and buys drones, is it a zero-sum game and we're back to square one?
Yeah, let's come back to this Ukraine and the military buildup that takes place actually currently on the borders of Ukraine. Because what we see from the Russian side is unprecedented gathering of all types of troops that was reported by different, including by independent sources, since 2014 and the invasion of eastern Ukraine by Russia. So the Ukrainians plus the European Union and NATO are extremely concerned by the situation, and that's why all the European leaders were talking with Vladimir Putin and making some quite harsh statements. Also, the American the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, William Burns, was also in Russia a week ago or 10 days ago, and he also warned Russia to stop this military buildup. So I don't, the fact that Ukrainians are getting drones from Turkey is something normal. Each country tries to catch up in this modernization of its military forces. I don't think the Ukrainians are planning right now to invade. By the way, it's their internationally recognized territory. So, but they are not planning to go farther and to retake back some parts of Donbas that is currently not under their control. Because it's now what I see that most of Ukrainians and the Ukrainian government tries to consolidate the rest of Ukraine to go and to get as close as possible with NATO membership. Starting a new war or escalating the new war, which will not allow Ukraine to get closer with NATO, because they know that most of European countries, especially Western Europeans, they will not take Ukraine on board in the conflict with Russia. So it's in Ukraine's interest, for me, to freeze the conflict in eastern Ukraine, in this part of Donbas that is not under their control, and to consolidate their institutions and to get as close as possible to NATO and EU membership. This is in their interest.
Javed Agah, let me ask you, because I didn't get a chance earlier. The right now where you're sitting in Baku, what's the view when they see the rivalry between Russia and Turkey, and when they see again those Turkish made drones that have helped out Azerbaijan in last year's war? Is there still the feeling that it's a former Soviet state, or is there a feeling that perhaps Azerbaijan is looking elsewhere?
I don't think that we are looking elsewhere, but we are not either a former Soviet country anymore. I mean, there has been a huge amount of Russian-speaking schools and in the society, but it's changing. People are more English speaking right now, and after the war, people have been in some sort of happy feeling that everything is going to be all right with this pride. But after the a year later, they are now asking what's going to happen now. Are we going to go back to settle? Are we going to rebuild Karabakh? And there's going to be a lot of investments from European companies and Turkish companies as well. And also, of course, some Russian, but these are the minimized.
Do people in Azerbaijan feel closer to Turkey or to Russia?
We always felt closer to Turkey. Like it has been for 30 years now. I'm 28 years old and I've learned Turkish from TV. So we have been very close, and there have been Turkish schools in Azerbaijan. Azerbaijanis mostly go to Turkish universities to study. Their media, their culture really affects us. We are leading world classics from Turkish translations mostly. So it is changing, but I would not say that it's going towards Europe, but somewhere in the middle.
Well, we're coming up to the 30th anniversary of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and even before the announcement back on in December of 1991, Armenia and Azerbaijan were already at war, as Jacques-Marie Dossian was saying earlier. Here we can show images from 1991. Jacques, when you look with hindsight at those images, what goes through your mind?
What we just said recently, we have two different questions. One is strategic. With a high-intensity conflict like the one we have seen last year, the challenge for Russia and maybe also for other armies is how can we respond to a massive drone attacks? What is our flexible response? And this is a challenge for many, many armed forces in the world.
And when you look at these images from 30 years ago?
Yes. At that time, the conflict was not religious. Because you had two states, Armenia and Azerbaijan, were two former Soviet Union states. It's what a question just of territory, does or not Karabakh can take its independence from Azerbaijan. What has changed the last 30 years, mainly because of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan wants to become the leader in that region, a Muslim leader. And that's why nowadays we have this problem that the expansionism of Turkey in South Mediterranean and, of course, in Caucasus creates a problem because under a religious flag, now he can have a connection with Azerbaijan and a few other countries.
Tornike Gordadze, is this how you read it?
I don't fully agree with this religious component of the conflict. There is a religious component, but which is not very important so far. Just to remind that Turkey is a Sunni country, 90% or more of the Turkish population is Sunni, and 70% of Azerbaijanis are Shia. So this is one huge difference. And also, Azerbaijani state is very strongly a secular state. And themselves, the President Aliyev, even if we can criticize him a lot about democracy, he's someone who is really afraid of religious extremism. So he was the friendship or alliance between Turkey and Azerbaijan is an old alliance, which is more cultural and ethnic, based on cultural and ethnic proximity, and also on geopolitics. Yes, Mr. Erdogan wants to play a role in South Caucasus to reach also Central Asia from across the Caspian. But I don't think in this particular dossier he's playing the religious card. He may play the religious card somewhere else with different networks or linked to Muslim brotherhoods, etc. But in this particular region, I don't think he's playing the religious card. It's more geostrategic, and also the competition with Russia is very important because on one side we see them appearing Turkey and Russia as allies when they try together to diminish Western influence in different regions of the world. But on the other side, there is a huge competition between them: Ukraine, Black Sea, Caucasus, Balkans, Syria, Libya. These are the cases where Turkey and Russia are clashing. The only thing that keeps them together, and they don't trust each other, I can tell you, is that both agree on the fact that they don't want the West to be very influent in the conflicts that I've just mentioned.
All right, that's their common ground. Tornike Gordadze, I want to thank you so much for joining us from Berlin. Andrei Kortanov in Moscow, Javid Aga in Baku, Jacques-Marie Lossian, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.